Divine Mother,
beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
dearest Mother,
saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Wonderful to be here, and all of our celebrations of Christmas and the New Year, and leaves a wonderful, purifying sense of fulfillment in coming through these holidays. There's so much spiritual vibration that is just in the air, and that is created through intense devotion and surrender to the one infinite being. In one way, you might say these are artificial dates that are set aside. But when tradition builds upon tradition, and every year there are those who attune themselves to the interior Christ, then it does indeed build a vibration. When Saint Francis made the first crush scene and established a cave, brought in some animals, put in a Christ manger scene for a Christ child, everything except for the child itself. And then with such devotion, such ardent surrender and focus upon the Christ alone, it manifested a light that was so brilliant that neighboring villages thought that there was some fire, and they came there prepared to put out the fire. And when they got there, they were amazed to see the Saint Francis and these devotees around with these animals, looking at this empty little cradle that they had made, filled with straw, and the radiant Christ was being manifest there through their devotion. And so we tune into that. We feel the great devotion and love of that. And it builds year after year. And as we move forward into the future, the more people who take the time to really meditate upon that Christ child, not so much just the social aspect, it's wonderful to have the food and the smells and the gathering of families and all the other things that happen. But how much more is it to spiritualize the day and to feel that Christ spirit, that Christ love, that Christ consciousness lifting us up and transforming us. And so this is something that Master initiated. He would have a spiritual Christmas, and then the next day on Christmas Day he would have social Christmas. And on spiritual Christmas they would spend 6 hours in deep meditation. And Master would oftentimes feel Jesus' presence so imminently that he felt that he was with them in the room itself. And this can sound like imagination to some, but when you've had that experience and you feel the very presence of Jesus Christ being with you in the room and even perhaps physically manifesting, all of these things are possible. I remember once feeling so greatly the spirit of Lhari Mahashai. And in my internal vision, I saw him manifesting before me. And then amazingly, when I opened my eyes, there he was in body. And I bowed down at his feet. And it gives me chills just to even think about it now. And felt physically himself manifest there. And so these are wonderful things, but they all point to one direction, and that is the purification, upliftment, and transformation that our mind, body, and consciousness goes through. I would like to read here from Papa Ram Dass' God Experience, dated 19th March, 1961. Ram Dass speaking. The devotee cries to God, O Lord, my eyes are not thirsty to see you. Ears are not eager to hear your glories. Sleep is absolutely out of my control. In this condition, where is the possibility of my realizing you? How can I forget the world? By forgetting the world alone, the inner awakening comes. When your thirst for God is intense, all the senses are unattached to the objects of the world. They become perfectly pure, calm, and controlled. Sense objects should not disturb or attract you. If they do, you are unfit for sadhana. There must be real hunger for God. The longing for jnana or moksha should be intense. Then the world has no attraction for you, else the mind longs for the pleasures of the senses, with the result that God remembrance and meditation become impossible. To illustrate this, the example of the hen sitting on the eggs for hatching is given. She concentrates her whole mind on the eggs. That you can find out from her eyes, the eyes are vacant. They see and see not. Such must be the concentration of one seeking the Atman. The Gita says the seeker of God should be like the tortoise, which withdraws its limbs whenever it wants. Likewise, we should withdraw our senses and not allow them to go outward. Spiritual practice becomes possible only if it is backed up by vairagya or dispassion. Merely external vairagya will never do. Inner vairagya must be there. That is, born of sincere, wholehearted aspiration to realize God. When the heart aspires, the indriyas do not function in the manner they did before. They function harmlessly without hankering after objects. They cooperate with you in your quest. When you have intense vairagya, the practice of meditation and concentration becomes fruitful. Otherwise, there will be a tug-of-war within you, a protracted struggle in which the indriyas seek to go outwards and your mind strives to go inwards. It is this problem that Arjuna posed before Sri Krishna. I intellectually understand you, but I cannot practice it because mind is as restless as the wind. How can I control it? How can I fix it upon one point within myself? Sri Krishna said, It is true, Arjuna. Mind is difficult to control. It is restless. But there is a way to do it, abhasya and vairagya. If there is no vairagya, the spiritual aspirant cannot succeed in realizing the truth. That this vairagya is mainly a state of inner renunciation, a condition of the mind. There are many persons who pass for vairagyas because they have given up their homes, but they have not given up samsara of the mind. Their mind is not free from attachments. They are not vairagis in the real sense of the term. Having realized the hollowness of the ephemeral nature of life and pleasures, the real vairagis are no longer drawn to them. Their minds recoil from things outside. That recoil is vairagya. That comes when you seek the eternal with all of your heart. It is truly said that through vichara, you get vairagya. When you know that tuning your life with the eternal is the only way for real happiness and peace, then naturally the external objects do not attract you. And it is easy for the mind to be drawn inward in meditation. Then the mind will disappear, and you will know you are in reality the all-blissful truth, or Atman. I have given up this thing and that thing. I have given up my job. It is not by these that you realize the truth. free the mind from longings for objects of the senses by one pointed, concentrated, intense longing for God realization. It is not by these things that you realize the truth. Free the mind from longing for objects of the senses by one pointed, concentrated, intense longing for God realization. The fire of that longing must be kept burning bright in your heart till all desires of the world are reduced to ashes. Then you will have real Vairagya, and so long as Vairagya is there, mind does not cling to the things of the world. It gets absorbed in the self, with the capital S, is lost in contemplation and meditation. Who meditates? The mind meditates. Atman does not meditate. The object is to still the mind. Stilling the mind is not easy when it is running about. When the mind ceases to be, then you realize you are the Atman. Look without seeing, hear without listening, eat without tasting. That is the thing you have to attain through longing for God. It does not come to you if you merely wish for it. It is a result of intense longing for God, bhakti. Such is bhakti, a devotion that keeps away all thoughts except of God. Now you have rejected the unreal and identified yourself with the real. Your connection with the unreal is lost when you identify yourself with the real. It is a necessary or inevitable corollary. Therefore, you make no distinction between the external and the internal, the manifest and the unmanifest. A tremendous control over the mind is necessary. He is a hero who has conquered the mind and has eliminated it by realization of the Atman. The worst temptations cannot attract him. That is why sannyasins are made to wear cloth dyed in orange or gurua color. The color of the cloth represents flame, the flame of renunciation. A sannyasin is one in whom all craving and desires are burning as a flame. A Buddhist monk must wear the cloth of yellow color, the color of the dead body. He considers himself as walking dead body. He is dead to the world. He is dead to the passions, even as a dead body is no longer swayed by passions or attachments. We are too much conscious of the world, too much conscious of the things outside, either attracted or repelled by them. But the Vairagi has no craving for anything in the world. He seeks only the eternal. That is the main purpose of his life, and he is engaged day and night in that pursuit. When Sukadev was walking from one place to another, followed by Vyasa, his father, they had to pass by the side of the river where women were bathing without any cloth on their bodies. They were disporting themselves in water. Sukadev passed by without turning this way or that. His gaze was inward, and he was unmindful of his body and the surroundings, and the women did not take notice of him. Whereas Vyasa came near the river, the women at once covered themselves with their clothes. This shows Vyasa had not Sukadev's Vairagya. The one was dead to the world, the other is not. Attraction diverts the sight. The important thing is to control the sight. We can make out whether an aspirant is genuine or otherwise by looking at his eyes. His eyes are the windows of the soul. You must have a child's look, so innocent, guileless, free from passion and desire. Your eyes reflect the vasanas around in you. Your look is impure. What a vast difference there is between your look and that of a child. The mother remains even naked before a child, but not so before an elderly person. The child sees her, and her elderly person also sees her. The seeing is different. So Sukadev had the eyes of a child, and his father Vyasa had the eyes of an adult. Sukadev had the sight of oneness. Vyasa had the sight of duality. These great examples are before us to show which way we have to realize the truth. We should not allow the indriyas to play false or lead us astray. If we give them free reins, there is no hope for our realizing the truth. Do it as a practice at first by not letting your eyes dwell on objects of attraction. Afterwards, your sight becomes natural and pure like that of a child. In the child, there may be the hidden seed of desire. But in the sage, even the seed is destroyed, burnt to ashes in the fire of jnana. So his state is far more glorious than that of a child. Therefore, he is called a siddha, a perfected soul. He alone who has realized the truth and in whom all vasanas are extinct can be childlike. What a grand state it is when the seed of desire is completely destroyed in a person. To be desirelessless, how blessed it is. It reminds me of Mother saying that virginity is not a state we were born into, rather it is a state that we attain. Certainly to attain to this state is no easy matter. We feel that we are drawn to this world, and we may hear these words and think, how in the world can such a state be attained? And Papa certainly tells us that the sincere longing for God is the way to rise up to that state. But as God told me, the ego cannot kill the ego. The ego cannot transcend the ego. The best that the ego can do is surrender itself at God's feet. And as a result of that, God does the work of transformation. God is the purity that we seek, and when we touch the hem of his garment, then we are purified even as he is. So this is the way in which we can purify the mind. First of all, to withhold ourselves from those things that attract us too much in this world. We can look at certain things, and it has no attraction for us whatsoever. It's always been a mystery to me how people get involved in gambling, because the one time I was taken by friends down to Nevada, where there was gambling going on, and I took my little quarters and I went over to one of the machines, and pretty soon the quarters were gone. And perhaps I'm just too cheap, but I didn't want to put any more quarters into the machine. I was eating them and not giving anything back. Whereas others seem to get a great attraction for this, and they just will spend every amount of money that they have and more in order to gain profit from what they think will be their gambling profits. And so we look at this world, and everyone has different sources of attractions. But when we see something that inordinately attracts us, then we avert our gaze from it. Mother described these two eyes as the two thieves on either side of the Christ on the cross, which is the ajna point. And these two eyes draw us out through repulsion and attraction for various things. Now, we avert our gaze. But we get to that point, and how do we get to that point that Sukadev had, where he was so indrawn, he didn't even see the naked women who were bathing down by the river. He wasn't even having to avert his gaze in that way. His gaze was completely indrawn. And this comes as grace from God, truly. As God showed me one time, that in the beginning we take up meditation. And then when grace of God enters into us, meditation begins to take us up. In the beginning, we focus our attention, or try to focus our attention, on God. And it is a struggle. It is the battlefield that we enter onto. But when this grace comes in, this great kundalini force erupts inside of us, and it begins to lift us up. And it transforms us. It puts us through every experience that is necessary. Now, this is where we are on the cross. And the two thieves are on either side of us, the one that is positive and the other that is negative. But they are both thieves because even the one who is attracted to the good, to the beautiful, to the uplifting, is still represents attachment. And as a result of that, we can be lifted up in consciousness into the beautiful heavens. But we are attracted to the good, we are attracted to the light, but we must even surrender that. That is a difficult saying. Because even those things will keep us bound and from realizing the ultimate truth that is God. These are subtle, subtle things, because you think, well, I'm seeing into the heavens, I'm seeing light, I'm seeing saintly beings, and so on. But this becomes a trap at one point. In the beginning, we can get these kinds of visions, and they're inspiring and they're uplifting. But even having the darshan, as I had of Lari Mahashay, and feeling his feet, even that is a limitation. I remember being shocked when I was reading Papa's experiences and he had Krishna manifest himself physically in front of him. And he asked Krishna to take that away because he only wanted to see this entire universe as the body of Krishna and so transcend any form. Anything that can be born will die. And so he wanted to go beyond birth and death, beginnings and ends. He wanted to become established in the absolute purity of God consciousness itself. That which has no beginning and end is beginning and end, is more than beginning and end, because God is eternal. And so this is discrimination of the highest sort. Can you imagine? Jesus or Krishna, Buddha, Master, Mother, any of the great ones manifesting before you and say, take this away. I don't want it. Mother described the experience where she had the vision of Master once when she was going through this duality experience. And he had a point on his ajna. And in this vision, Master's face would move one way, but the dot wouldn't. Or the dot would move, but the face didn't. And she realized something was off, something was wrong here. And then she saw that it was another one who in India was regarded as a great spiritual master, but he came as Mother's opposing force. And she realized that he wasn't everything that he should be, and he was manifesting this vision of Master. And it was a false one. And so we get these things. And these are the dual forces as we go up. I've been reading through these letters that Mother and her one had exchanged back together, and our goal is to be able to publish these things, and they're very interesting. And Mother is describing here in 1961 experiences that she's been going through since coming back from India. She begins, "My beloved son, I know that by now you will have despaired of ever hearing from your little mother. The days have flown by, and each day I tell myself that surely God will permit me time to write you, but always something unexpected interferes, and I must of necessity adjust to his will. Letter writing seems to be a never-ending battle with me, and I get terrifically frustrated when I am constantly in the position of having unanswered correspondence hanging over my head. Also, it has taken me time to level off and adjust to the last spiritual experience I had. This, in many ways, was by far the greatest test, but the reward of realization has been equally great. Each witness sees outwardly only a portion of the manifestation of such an experience, being unable to perceive or conceive the enormity of the impact and inner turmoil which goes on within the individual striving for God realization. Neither do they realize how long it takes for the electrical forces which stimulate the brain at such a tremendous rate of frequency during revelation to gradually subside and return to the normal conscious level. Even that level changes to some degree because of the exalted state to which the spiritual aspirant has arisen. Truly, he is in the world, but not of it. The, quote, pearl of great price, close quote, is rightly named because the cost is indeed great, but it has ever been so. The more perfect the jewel, the greater the price, but if one's desire for it is strong enough, one does not count the cost. You did not mention whether you're still contemplating taking over the managership of Woodsman Circle. It sounded like a wonderful opportunity. You say that your life is dedicated to the ministry, but I think you limit God and yourself when you try to encompass it and channel it in only one direction. To be a true minister of God is to serve in any capacity which He directs. To ask God for direction and yet refuse it when it comes because of a previously fixed idea is to deny the help given, which, of course, retards spiritual progress. I served God in many ways for many years before Master finally made me a minister. How wise He was! The tests are great, but only through the experiences of everyday living do we grow in tolerance and understanding. It provides the natural field for growth and expansion, teaches us the meaning of faith, of acceptance of the will of God, and of the final surrender to the infinite beloved. Having the title of Doctor of Divinity does not necessarily qualify one to administer to the spiritual needs of God's children. In these days, and particularly in this country, we are inclined to put the cart before the horse. Jesus said, "Seek ye first God and His kingdom, and all of these things shall be added unto you." This does not mean that until we find our union with Him, should we sit with our hands folded in our laps, but rather, while ever seeking to remove the veils of ignorance from before our eyes, we serve in whatever way is made possible to us. All phases of life and living are part of our training for the ministry. One of the most necessary things is to find yourself by yourself, to explore your inner depths, to see yourself as you really are, and to overcome gradually all that causes you to stand in the shadow of your own light, because in truth you are the light, my son. As James Warnick so aptly put it, when you realize that you are older than the oldest star and younger than the last assembled sun, then you will not need to ask admittance to paradise, for you already will with His will. With complete surrender comes all the love, the light, the wonder, and the beauty that we have hungered for so long. It is the fulfillment of our dream, oneness with Him while we are living a life of tremendous activity through love and service to the divine. We have had several opportunities and invitations to travel to various places, but God feels that it is time for us to return home to Seattle so that we may consolidate our efforts and build a firm foundation. We have been traveling more or less constantly since 1954, making a dent here and there, gathering a few lambs into the fold, and of course, above all, going through the necessary experiences which have brought us to our present state of God realization. I do not know exactly what His plan is, but there is much to be done. For the present, you can help best by doing what I have already suggested in this letter. We're going to take care of Uncle Fred again during the month of September so Margaret can get much needed rest. We're giving up our apartment and leaving for Seattle on August 28th, and we'll stay at Gary's until Margaret leaves around the 1st. While we are there, we plan to look for a house which will provide more adequate facilities for our work. If possible, I want to spend most of my time writing, but, of course, I leave that up to God. Financial state is as usual, so inasmuch as it is His will that we go there, He will have to furnish whatever is necessary to make it possible. Dan and Sue have given us all the furniture which we have been using here, which is wonderful, and shows that he has already started providing for our needs. As you know, we have no bed, dresser, davenport, etc., of our own, any more than so we are deeply grateful. Phil and Jean have also offered us everything we are using of theirs, with the exception of the dining room table and chairs, which were a wedding present from Jean's folks. What wonderful people! Of course, God saw to it that we kept our dining room table and chairs that we had us on the 19th. That is their house on the 19th. If I continue to talk to you all day, it doesn't seem like anyone else will be hearing from me, so I had better get on with the next letter. My blessed son, we love you with all of our hearts unconditionally and unceasingly. We miss you more than we can tell you, but also we want only that which is for your highest good in God. God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform, and who knows why he has taken you to Alaska. Perhaps this is the first field job that you have wanted for so long, and from a seed a mighty tree will grow. I know that you will never forget that it is our Father alone who doeth the works. He is forever within you, guiding you and protecting you in all that you do. May the flame of your love for him kindle the spark of desire in the hearts of all those whom you meet, so that they too may worship his lotus feet. Ever thyself, Mother. Isn't it wonderful to have these letters? And in looking through other materials, I found this letter from Father Hamilton from Anandashram, dated Tuesday, March 11th. Dearly beloved, this is a letter from Father to the group in Seattle. God's will is indeed mysterious, and his test provides us are sometimes rigorous to the very limit of our endurance. Mother Mildred has been desperately ill since Monday, February 24th, and until Monday, March 3rd, it has been a terrible struggle, physically, mentally, and spiritually. She had no sleep, no food, no liquids, a raging fever that seldom abated, many deep spiritual experiences, and periods when the fever took over. On March 3rd, she began to show signs of improvement, and today she is almost herself again, except that she weighs 103 pounds and has practically no strength. Vitality, love of God, faith, and devotion to her Master, she has in abundance. And these, with God's grace through Papa, Swami Ramdas, pulled her through. Her mouth and throat were badly infected by dehydration and fever, and she has taken no food nor liquid except for glucose water until yesterday, when she managed a cup of milk. She had the most loving care and attention of Ramdas, Mother Krishnabai, and everyone at the ashram. And the ashram doctor, another young doctor from Kanangad, and a doctor from the hospital at Mangalore have been in attendance. She has been getting shots of B12 and B-complex and folic acid to clear up infection and build up the blood, and to clear the mouth and throat so she can breathe, swallow, and talk comfortably. Right now she is enjoying the first really quiet, peaceful sleep she has had since February 24th. Today we will make her eggnog and see if she can swallow it. It will be another week or so before she has strength to go out and move about. My thanks go to God for preserving her life, her reason, and her security in the arms of God. And all those who love her will pray deeply for the continued flow of grace upon her, so that her recovery may continue and may be complete and rapid. We were most fortunate in having continued cool weather all during her illness, only yesterday bringing the first taste of summer heat. There being no ice available and water coming from the wells, which are rapidly warm by the sun, The problem of keeping her cool during fever was a severe one. Constantly wringing out cloths for her face and neck in cool water was all we could do, but it helped enough. The burden she bore was not just that of her own self, and she will have wonderful experiences to tell of it later days. Our recognition of God's bounty grows daily. On every hand, God showers His love and grace upon us. The money sent by the church, as well as that sent by others during the last few weeks, has come during the time it was needed. Truly, God sends all the means of handling the tests when He sends the tests themselves. And those who are His instruments are also blessed for following the dictates of their hearts. To overcome reason's problem by heart's love is not always easy, but it must be learned, and the results therefrom are rewards, if rewards are looked for, are truly wonderful. Isn't that lovely? To overcome reason's problem by heart's love is not always easy, but it must be learned, and the rewards resulting therefrom, if rewards are looked for, are truly wonderful. From all reports, I feel the church is doing very well. Everyone must do their part in maintaining an unbroken chain of communion with God and Master, and in utilizing the efforts of those who keep the work going. Times and duties press hard sometimes. And that was the first page, and the second page has not showed up yet, so we hope that it will. We're beginning a new year, and as a result of that, we can look forward to the empty pages in the Book of God. And how are we to fill these pages day by day, moment by moment, as we go through the year? When we take our lives seriously, that is to say, we don't just keep coasting along from day to day, but we really take ourselves in hand, that we really take seriously that we are to become masters of ourselves in this life. Then we will really focus our attention. Even as devotees, we can be sincere to a degree. We read the books, we listen to the talks, we seek to meditate every morning and every night, as we promise to do. And yet, there can be a lack of depth, a lack of urgency that goes with our spiritual practice. We do not know ever how long we have in this life. We can presume that we will live today what is an ordinary life, perhaps in your 80s or your 90s, and that you have plenty of time in order to make the realization of God. But I can tell you one thing, that when you begin to really feel God's presence, you wonder why you ever delayed even a moment. Now, to focus your full attention upon God is not concentrating on Him in a way that gives you a headache because there's so much tension in you, but it is to make God an attractive proposition, that you look to the attributes of God, the peace of God, the love of God, the joy of God, the light of God. These things gain an attraction to you that is beguiling, that you cannot easily put aside. When Sukadev was walking by this river, and these ladies were bathing in it, His attention was drawn deeply into the interior consciousness. As I speak to you, I feel this deep vibration in the ajna. That is the third eye point, the point between the eyebrows. And that vibration goes out from the ajna and merges out into a vast field of consciousness. It does not feel like that there are any limits, there are no boundaries to it. Now, initially, when we first get a sense of this, it can be intimidating. it can stir up fears in us. What's on the other side? What will we experience? If we enter out into a vast space, who will I be? How will I know who I am? These are the kinds of fears that the ego mind take up. But as we encounter this vast field of consciousness and we continue to enter into it, we soon realize that there is indeed nothing to fear at all. That the sense of I transforms, it changes. It moves from this little sense of I that defines itself by this body, what it does in the world, its relationship to the object of senses. And now it merges into this divine vibration of God, this Christ consciousness. It feels that it has finally arrived at home. It is experiencing the vast sense of peace and joy and light. These are not things that the ordinary ego mind can even grasp, because it says in the scriptures that no man has ever seen God, and this is true. Because you have to transcend that which is your human experience, because that is limitation by definition. In order to expand out into the vastness of God consciousness, you leave behind the littleness of the I that formerly identified itself with the body and the ego. You leave it behind, and you do it through God's grace. God lifts you up. God changes you. God takes you into this incredible experience. And as a result of that, you are reborn. Not as a human being. As Nicodemus said, can a man crawl back into his mother's womb and be reborn? It's a pure silliness when you think about it in that way. But you're reborn as a spiritual being, as a son of God. And this is a brand new thing. It's just not simply going down to the altar where the minister is going to lead you through an acceptance that you now accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. That's what's common today. It's so much more than that. It tests you down to the very basic fundamentals of your psychology, everything that you cling to in this world. And that can seem off-putting if you haven't put yourself into that total state of surrender yet, where you have realized that everything you have clung to has produced nothing but pain and suffering. You know, why do we not go through this experience? It's because we feel identified with the things of this world, even when we complain about it, even when we don't like it. But just on the other side of this dislike is the attraction for those things. I don't like this world because I don't have enough money, I don't have enough friends, things don't come easily enough for me. But on the other side of that dislike, and it can be intense dislike for this life, is an attraction. But I want money. I want more friends and adulation. I want these things. And so the very indication that I hate this world, or I hate being in this world in the way that I am, indicates that you are attached to the things of this world. So we must give it up, all of it. Do you see? They're the good and the bad thief on either side of the cross. Both must be given up. But, as Jesus said to the good thief, when it surrendered itself to God and Christ by its side, take me with you into heavenly consciousness. And Jesus said, verily you will be. The good attributes, the positive attributes, the seeking out for beauty and wonder and love, will rise up into heavenly consciousness, and now that gets transformed as well. It is no longer just wedded to, I want other people to love me, but rather I feel the love for all others, God's love, and it is without attachment. It flows out of you because God loves this world. God loves all beings, and that universal love flows through you. You open these two eyes, and you now see the world. And you may see beauty, and you may see ugliness, but both are equal before you in the sense that God's intelligence, God's beauty, God's love resides behind everything that is. When you go to a movie and you watch the villain, or you watch somebody go through a very difficult experience, perhaps somebody dies of some long illness, but they do it in a heroic kind of way. And you come out of the movie and you may have tears coming down from your eyes and you'll say, that was such a good movie. Now, doesn't that look strange on the surface? If you were just walking by that person coming out of the movie, you saw tears of sadness and grief coming down, and they said, that was such a good movie. And you'd wonder, how can they think that? And yet, it is true, isn't it? We have all been where there has been battle, where there has been war, where there have been other kinds of things portrayed in the movie, and yet we think it's a wonderful movie. Even though it's covering difficult things, it gives you a little hint of what it can be like to look behind the veil of ignorance in which we do not see God's will being manifest in all things, truly from a human standpoint. There are things that we like and that we don't like, things that we admire and other things that we abhor. And you would say good people even have this sense of what is right and what is wrong. And on your upward journey towards God, these are necessary discriminations to come to. But there is a greater discrimination. There is a greater state of consciousness to arrive at. And that is because Mother distinguished between saint consciousness and cosmic or universal consciousness. And in saint consciousness, you're still very much attracted to the good and doing good, and versus not staying away from those things that are wrong, that are bad, that are not according to the rules. But in cosmic consciousness, you go beyond that, because being attached to doing good even is an attachment. And so you transcend that, you go beyond that. And you may even be prompted to do something that the world may think is wrong. And yet, you do it because God is prompting you. Master said an amazing thing one time. He said that even if the entire world should disagree with him, but he felt it was God's direction and guidance to do it, he would do it. Now, we can perhaps easily say, oh, well, that would be me too. But the entire world? Everybody disagreeing with you? And yet you feel deep down in your soul that it is God's direction, then you must do it. You must do it. It's an interesting story that goes with Rama, and he is going to kill the evil Ravana. And Ravana has wreaked havoc not only on earth, but even in heavenly kingdoms. And that he is the ultimate in evil. And the story is said that he was one of the guards to Indra's heaven. And that a great saint came to him and said, give me admittance. But he had had orders from Indra not to admit anyone. And so the saint gave him a curse because he was upset in the moment that he hadn't done it. All of this is by God's design, of course. And so as a result of this curse, he was going to live in hell for so many lifetimes, have to come back to this earth many, many lifetimes. And then he was approached and he was given the choice. And he said, you can play this ultimate villain for Rama. You're a great, great soul. And it takes a great soul in order to play that oppositional force. And so you can play that opposite force for Rama and have one lifetime in which you'll have to endure the worst villainy. And you'll have to perpetrate it as well, but that it will serve God's purpose ultimately. Or you can live out these many, many, many lifetimes in a hellish kind of existence. And so he took the one lifetime. And whenever Rama or Lakshman would see him in his body as he manifested as Ravana, they would admire him. They say, look at, he glows with spiritual power and light, but he was that oppositional force. And they knew that they must defeat him. And so this is all part of God's play. Now, the people around didn't know that Ravana had voluntarily taken on this role. They saw him as the greatest evil in the world. And so he was manifesting. But can you imagine the deep humility that it would take to play a villain to even God himself? And as a way of manifesting greater light in this world. So it doesn't mean that we are completely indifferent to good and evil as long as that is the higher light within us. As long as we are learning the ABCs of discrimination, it's important to realize the subtleties of right and wrong. But that at some point we have to transcend even that. We don't remain attached to the evildoers. We don't look for vengeance. We don't look to entangle ourselves in people who do wrong. Many times we're put into situations. I myself was put in a situation as I was going through these experiences. And this particular individual who I worked with at the time conceived of a great hatred for me and wanted to destroy my reputation and set out to do so and told lies and did everything that she could do to destroy me in this way. And there were those around who knew what she was doing and stood by and didn't do a thing. And I knew somehow, through God and Guru's grace, not to react, not to engage, that I kept my mind upon God alone. Now, I wasn't a doormat about it, but I didn't retaliate. I didn't try to sink to her own level. Nor was I overly disturbed. It was a strange thing to know that you are the object of someone's hatred, especially when you don't know what, if anything, you've done to deserve this. And so it was part of the experiences that God orchestrated for me. And even Jesus, the great avatar, was subject to humiliations by others and the spreading of lies. And he said, for what? All I have done is spoken the truth. All I have done is manifested the light. All I have done is healed and done everything that God has prompted me to do. And yet you spread lies, yet you want to kill me. You hate me. Now he had it within him, knowing the truth within him, not because he is egotistical, but because he absolutely knew that what he was manifesting was the highest consciousness. He felt it in every cell of his being. Therefore, he could rest comfortably that he had done everything according to God, and he could also know without any doubt that what these individuals were responding to was the very fact that he did manifest that light, and that they were living in darkness, and they wanted to preserve that darkness. And you can know this within yourself as well, that when you feel God so greatly inside of you and manifesting through your heart, through your mind, through your words, through your actions, and others are retaliating against you, that these individuals live in the dark and they are trying to preserve that darkness, and the very thing that disturbs them is the fact that you are living in that light and manifesting it. They don't like it. They don't want it. There were those in Master's organization. Master Mother wrote them and said, well, at God's direction, she was coming down for one of the convocations. And the leader of SRF at the time said, dismissed it. Oh, at God's direction. As if that only Master could feel God's direction and no one else. You see how it twines itself in, where the ego enters in. And perhaps because you don't feel God's direction very strongly, and you think you must be the top of the heap, no one else must. But truly, God can manifest in the least of these, in a child, through nature, can come to you in so many ways and speak the most powerful and profound truths. And so it requires deep humility and attunement to God to rise above the dualities and to manifest only that which God wishes to you. He will use you. You know, I was asking God, I said, you know, so many times in this body, it feels like you are this immense whale that is swimming in a tiny little pool. And it shakes this frame, it shakes this body from stem to stern. Why do you not allow this little fish to merge out into your ocean and merge with the ocean, become one with the ocean? And he answered me, and he says, you have merged in this ocean. But it is my leela, it is my play, that I should be the whale that plays in the tiny little pool. And for you not to work against that, it's my will. And so he does as he wills. He told me that if I merged into him completely, this world would cease to be able to see me and know me. And that it was his will to work through this form. And he did it in this way. Sometimes I wonder whether I have fulfilled Mother's highest teachings, because she described being able to operate on any plane at all. And yet, he keeps me so deeply indrawn into his nature. And the work that I do sometimes is very strange. Suddenly, in the work that I'm doing, Carl will notice that there's just this heavy stench in the room. And it's as if sulfur and wicked things have entered in, and it's the working out through God in this form. And it's nothing that I do, I can tell you that. It is something that he does alone. And so you'd never know which direction God will take you. He has given me this baptism of fire that has gone on for so many years. And I think I must have been very wicked at one time, because this fire seems to go on and on and on. But these are his purifying fires, and even when you're done with your own purification, if it be his will, you will remain, and you will help out to work out the greater purification for this world, not just for yourself, but for others as well. And so it's wonderful and it's beautiful. But it requires absolute and total surrender to him in every detail. But there is no life I would rather have, not even close. And so as we eye this new year, thinking about writing upon the blank pages of God's book of life, let us seek to write his name on every page, in every sentence, in every word, that it is his vibration. As Mother said in this letter to Herwin, don't try to dictate to God how he should serve through you. Rather, tune in to him. Surrender to his will. Let him show you how to serve him. You may think, but my life is ordinary. It doesn't have anything extraordinary in it. But if that's how God chooses to serve in you in this moment, so be it. So be it. Make the most of it. Fill it with sacredness and divine consciousness. And allow God to work his will through you. You will never know when he will use you to effect some great good in this world, and you may never even know it, because he has done it through you and manifested it, and perhaps only at a great distance and time later will you know what he has done. So let us serve humbly, and let us with complete, total devotion and surrender to Him. Enter into this new year and make it the most beautiful, light-filled, sacred, devotional year ever. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet. Surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Deeply to the light within you, and that it might manifest the greatest glory of God, Christ, Gurus, within and without.